Tuesday, July 7th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, is the U.S. coronavirus pandemic starting to become a runaway train?
We are still knee-deep in the first wave of this.
Major legal victories for Native Americans and environmentalists, and a blow to the Trump administration.
An adequate and proper environmental review would show that this project is too risky to be approved.
Also ahead, remembering a country music pioneer. It's all on today's International Edition. Thanks so much for being with us today as we begin with the latest on the novel coronavirus pandemic. India on Monday overtook Russia to record the world's third highest number of infections, while the U.S. coronavirus deaths topped 130,000 amid a surge in new cases. Nationally, new cases have risen every week for five straight weeks. In a National Institutes of Health webcast, Chief U.S. Infectious Disease Physician Dr. Anthony Fauci said the state of the virus in the U.S. is not good.
Europe, the European Union as an entity, it went up and then came down to baseline. Now they're having little blips, as you might expect, as they try to reopen. We went up, never came down to baseline, and now we're surging back up. So it's a serious situation.
The United States saw a 27% increase in new cases of COVID-19 at the end of last week. And while many Americans are starting to feel anxiety and even depression over a crisis with no end in sight, Fauci offered some optimism.
We've already suffered through a lot of pain, a lot of economic and personal pain and inconvenience, but it will end. It will end because the public health efforts will succeed ultimately. And science will get us through this.
Still, health experts say the virus in the U.S. is currently outpacing an ability to contain it. Joining us to talk more about where things stand and where they may be heading is Dr. Arthur Kaplan, professor of bioethics at New York University Langone Medical Center. Thank you for being with us. Is this out of control right now in the United States?
I do think that the numbers are so bad, particularly in Florida, Arizona, some other parts of the United States, that we are almost to the point where we can't reverse things, even if we suddenly woke up and tried to do so. And so that means a real dramatic increase in hospitalizations and a dramatic increase in deaths. I think the president has hoped that maybe we could burn our way through this thing, just live with the impact of the virus, and then keep the economy going. But if the hospitalization and the deaths get as big as I worry that they will, it'll bring the economy down with them, because you can't run the country without a hospital system. You can't run the country without having access to healthcare. And if they're all full of COVID patients, it's just not going to be possible to keep things open and running.
So basically what you're saying is, even if we were to try to get a hold of this thing, it has outrun us?
I'm saying that I think it has outrun us, and we're going to have to deal with the deaths and the hospitalizations and the morbidity, because I fear that there isn't the will, as a matter of fact, to turn it around. There are a lot of Americans who are just saying, I'm tired of this. I don't believe that this is dangerous, so I'm not going to do what anybody tells me to do anyway. And the spike in numbers is so big and escalating up so fast in so many places that it just looks like it is going to be very difficult to bring it back under control unless we got 95% mass compliance, testing, tracing to quarantine people. But we're not headed that way. We're headed toward reopening schools, reopening sports, keep the economy moving. That's the message that a large percentage of American politicians are sending, and that bodes ill.
Right.
Plus, just to depress every single person who's listening to this, I worry that the flu and measles are going to come back into a doomsday scenario. Remember, people aren't taking their children to get their vaccinations to the doctor for various reasons. They're not going there, fear, or because there wasn't school to help make sure that they got their shots. I worry that we're going to see measles outbreaks. Flu season was ending when COVID started around the world, but it'll be beginning soon enough in November, December, particularly in the southern U.S. We can have COVID, flu, and measles all jumping around at the same time.
Mm, And then I've heard there's some other new swine flu in China that has potential to also become a pandemic. What do you know about that?
I've seen reports that say there's been a mutation causing a different nasty form of swine flu, and you can get both flu and swine flu returning at the same time. So if you really want to go for the four-way misery, yep, you could add mutated new form of swine flu into the mix. If there ever was a year to get a flu shot, this is the year.
If this is as bad as it looks and as bad as you are basically validating, where do we go from here? Is it safe to say there is no end in sight in the near future for this situation?
The worst situation for the U.S. is to become a pariah, no travel allowed in or out of the country. Other countries basically saying, we can't have you come here. You're just too many people, too infected, whether it's Canada, Europe, or other places. I worry, too, that, as I said, the hospital system may begin to strain and have to turn down elective procedures or even make decisions, I hope not, among emergency cases, COVID and not. So that will be tremendous horror story here. I think also that our best bet to work our way out is not behavior change. I've kind of given up on that. And now it's find a drug that treats or hopefully find a vaccine that prevents. I just worry that we're going to have, say, a year, year and a half before we get there on either a treatment or a vaccine.
So all this talk about the end of the year for a vaccine or early next year is probably wishful thinking.
If you look at where the vaccines are, people are starting to recruit large numbers of Americans to take the experimental vaccine, but that means tens of thousands, usually 20, 30,000 people. Can't shortcut that because you'll scare people and they won't take the vaccine. Absolute solid evidence that it's safe and effective. If we're lucky, got the first one out of the box to be pretty effective, which is a big bit of luck, I think the studies would get done and you might have manufacturing and distribution by the middle of next year earliest.
Dr. Arthur Kaplan, professor of bioethics at New York University Langone Medical Center. The World Health Organization, meanwhile, is reviewing a report making the case that advice on the coronavirus needs updating after some scientists sent a letter to the health agency outlining evidence that the virus can spread by tiny airborne particles. In Kenya, President Uhuru Kenyatta announced Monday a list of directives for the country's phased reopening. The president lifted the ban on travel restrictions in countries that were mostly affected by the coronavirus. He also announced that domestic air travel will resume starting next week and international flights August 1st. As Rael Ambour reports from Nairobi, the president said the revised measures are meant to strike a balance between containing the disease and stopping the economy from sinking.
President Uhuru Kenyatta has eased the restrictions that were put in place early March to contain the spread of the coronavirus. In a nationwide address Monday, the president said this will be a phased reopening meant to strike a balance between containing the virus and sustaining the country's economic life. He said the restrictions on movements in and out of Nairobi, considered the country's coronavirus epicenter, will end on Tuesday. Travel in and out of Mombasa and Mandera, two of five other counties still under partial lockdown, had their restrictions lifted Monday afternoon, but with conditions, Kenyatta said.
Should the situation deteriorate and pose a challenge to our health infrastructure, we will have to revert back to lockdown. In the next 21 days, we shall study patterns of interactions and the spread of the disease. Any trends that signal a worsening of the pandemic, we will have no choice but to return to lockdown at zero option.
Kenyatta's address comes as the country battles a steep rise in confirmed COVID-19 cases. Kenya is seeing about 300 new cases each day, a figure that has more than doubled in the past month. Total COVID-19 cases now stand at 7,886, with 160 deaths. Some of the previous measures remain in place. Restrictions on political and social gatherings, together with the dusk to dawn nationwide curfew that was put in place in March, will continue for another 30 days, Kenyatta said. He said places of worship can open, but are limited to a maximum of 100 people inside, with events not lasting more than 1 hour. Congregants must be between ages 13 to 58 and have no underlying medical conditions. However, the president said local air travel will resume Wednesday, while international air travel will restart on the 1st of August. Kenyatta said his intention for the country was to reopen and to remain open, encouraging Kenyans to exercise shared and civic responsibility to ensure success.
But history has taught us that the COVID crisis is not the first health disaster with such enormous economic challenges. There were many more before this one. However, we must all be cognizant that those who overcame previous disasters and finished on top did so by first changing their mindsets. Put differently, it is not enough for the government to pump resources into the economy using stimulus instruments, as we have been doing. Such efforts will undoubtedly go to waste if people do not co-create solutions with the government.
Kenyatta said he believes the path to recovery will be rocky and uneven, but ultimately can be navigated. Raya Lumbor for VOA News, Nairobi.
Tourists from 15 countries outside of the European Union are being allowed to enter Italy with no need to quarantine, but much to the detriment of the tourism industry, Americans are not on that list. The already hard-hit economy due to COVID-19 is going to suffer significant losses due to the lack of Italy's biggest spenders when on holiday in the country, Americans. Sabina Castelfranco reports from Rome.
Tourists are back in Italy, a country that a few months ago was the epicenter of the coronavirus outbreak in Europe, suffering nearly 35,000 deaths. Since the country began reopening its borders on June 3rd, European travelers were the first to return, and then starting last week, those from a number of non-EU nations followed. However, American tourists, the second largest group of visitors to Italy after the Germans, are still barred from entering the country, except for urgent reasons. Today, the few American tourists seen in Italy often have a story to tell. Colleen Hewson, a retiree from the U.S. city of Detroit, and her husband came in March to visit the ruins at Pompeii, only to find it closed due to the pandemic. They were caught in Italy's lockdown, stayed, and were among the first to re-enter the archaeological site when it reopened at the end of May.
We're here on a vacation for our 30th anniversary, staying at an Airbnb with a local, and he was nice enough to accommodate us until the lockdown was over and the ruins have opened.
Expensive hotels popular with Americans, such as in the Amalfi Coast, are bracing themselves for big losses this vacation season. Some have partially reopened, while others not at all. 15 million Americans visit Europe each year, many of them during the summer. Their absence is a huge blow since they account for 10% of Europe's overall economy. The EU's decision to exclude people from certain nations, including the United States, is based on infection rates. Other major countries whose tourists are barred include Brazil and Russia. Citizens of Australia, Canada, Japan, and South Korea are allowed in. Last week, five American tourists made the news when they were denied entry to Sardinia, another favorite destination with Americans. They were forced to leave Cagliari Airport after flying into the Mediterranean island on a private jet. The Italian government says 5.6 million Americans visit Italy every year, with July being their most preferred month of travel. Aside from the more common destinations like Rome, Venice, Florence and Milan, many flock to the sea resorts like the Amalfi Coast and the major islands of Sardinia and Sicily, where the food and culture are named as the biggest draw. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
Two major oil and gas pipeline projects have been halted in recent days in the United States in a major win for Native Americans and environmentalists who protected the projects. Activists said the $3.8 billion Dakota Access and the $8 billion Atlantic Coast pipelines, as well as the Keystone, threatened waterways, forests, and public health, and would contribute to global warming. The decisions are a blow to President Trump's efforts to weaken public health and environmental protections that his administration views as obstacles to businesses. VOA's Jason Patinkin has the story.
Nearly 4 years ago, thousands of Native Americans flocked to the wind-swept plains of the U.S. state of North Dakota to protest the construction of an oil pipeline across the Missouri River. The pipeline, called Dakota Access, was first proposed to be built near a majority white city, but when the residents complained that it threatens their water supply, it was moved closer to land owned by Native American people instead. The natives complained that the pipeline would threaten their water, too, and set up vast protest camps to demand the pipeline company change course. Yet instead of listening to their concerns, the native people were met with force. Hundreds of heavily armed police attacked the protest camps, arresting hundreds, shooting projectiles into crowds, and unleashing chemical weapons. Native American activist Dallas Goldtooth of the Indigenous Environmental Network was on the front lines of the protests when the police attacked and spoke to VOA on the scene.
The world is going to see the ridiculous lengths that North Dakota is going to protect a multi-billion dollar oil corporation over the rights of indigenous people.
The native protesters were eventually defeated. Police cleared out the protest camps and the pipeline was built across the river. But today, Goldtooth is celebrating. That's because on Monday, a federal court ordered that the Dakota Access Pipeline stop pumping oil within 30 days in response to a lawsuit brought by the Cheyenne River and Standing Rock tribes. The court said that the U.S. government broke the law by granting the energy company the right to build the pipeline across the Missouri River without properly investigating the environmental risks, just as the Native American tribes claimed. Now, the U.S. government must complete an environmental impact statement to see what harm the pipeline poses to the tribe's water sources. To Goldtooth, the court ruling is vindication after years of struggle.
This is huge. This is huge. This is a tremendous victory in our struggle to recognize our treaty rights, our indigenous rights, and the fight to protect Mother Earth from fossil fuel expansion. There's not many examples of that happening in the United States where a large-scale crude oil pipeline has to stop operations after it's already started pumping oil through its pipes.
The order to shut down the Dakota Access Pipeline is part of a wave of decisions in recent days against the fossil fuel industry in the United States. On Sunday, the $8 billion Atlantic Coast Pipeline was canceled. That pipeline drew fierce criticism that it would damage pristine landscapes and harm wildlife. And late Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld a decision halting construction on the Keystone XL pipeline, which, if completed, would carry oil from Canada through the United States to the Gulf of Mexico. Goldtooth says that these decisions against pipelines show that the fossil fuel industry is struggling in the face of growing opposition.
We are seeing the fossil fuel industry on the ropes. You know, sustainable energy, renewable energy is on the uptick. Now is not the time to double down on fossil fuel projects. Now is the time to step away.
Reaction from the fossil fuel industry has been swift. Don Ness, president of the North Dakota Petroleum Council, told the Associated Press that he was shocked by the ruling against the Dakota Access Pipeline and said some oil producers in North Dakota would go into panic. Meanwhile, the United States Energy Secretary decried what he claimed would be, quote, loss of jobs throughout America, end quote, during an interview on U.S. TV network Fox Business. But Goldtooth says the Dakota Access ruling shows that oil companies must take indigenous people's environmental concerns into account before their projects receive approval.
An adequate and proper environmental review would show that this project is too risky to be approved. It is too much risk to the indigenous communities along its route, whose water would be directly threatened by a potential oil spill. It's too much risk for those indigenous communities at the source where the oil is being pumped from the ground, being extracted from the ground. And above it all, it's too much risk for the planet. Science has proven time after time, and indigenous knowledge has supported that time after time, that we have to keep fossil fuels in the ground in order to avoid greater climate chaos across this planet.
Goldtooth says it's likely that energy corporations will appeal the court decision on the Dakota Access Pipeline, but for now, this week's decisions show the power of the protests that spread across the windswept plains of North Dakota nearly 4 years ago.
This court decision would not have happened if it wasn't for the tremendous organizing and mobilization of indigenous peoples to defend their lands. It gives us courage, it gives us strength, and it just feeds our fire to continue to stand up and speak about our rights and demand that they be recognized.
Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Washington.
Here are some of the other stories we're following at VOA. A UN human rights investigator said Monday the January U.S. drone strike in Iraq that killed top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and 9 other people represented a violation of international law. The investigator said the U.S. has failed to provide sufficient evidence of an ongoing or imminent attack against the interests to justify the strike on Soleimani's convoy as it left the Baghdad airport. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's office announced Monday that he will not visit Washington with Mexico's president this week to celebrate a new North American trade deal after Canada raised concerns over potential U.S. aluminum tariffs. In a Monday morning phone call, Trudeau told Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador that he hoped the talks with U.S. President Donald Trump would be successful. Australia is considering offering safe haven visas to Hong Kong residents following the introduction of sweeping national security laws. Australia has said it's disturbed by the developments in Hong Kong and has received a request from Britain to share the burden if there is a widespread exodus from the territory. As Phil Mercer reports from Sydney, China strongly opposes the moves.
Britain has asked Australia and its other Five Eyes Alliance partners, Canada, New Zealand and the US, to help if people are forced to leave Hong Kong. The UK says it would offer asylum. Hong Kong residents fearing political persecution can already apply for protection under Australia's existing humanitarian program. Several government lawmakers in Canberra have been fiercely opposed to Beijing's crackdown on Hong Kong protesters. Prime Minister Scott Morrison says new resettlement plans are being drafted.
We are considering very actively in the proposals that I asked to be brought forward several weeks ago, and the filing touches are being put on those and they'll soon be considered by Cabinet to provide similar opportunities. And we think that's important and very consistent with who we are as a people.
In 2015, Australia granted emergency visas to 12,000 people fleeing the conflict in Syria. Bin Lin, a professor of Chinese law at the University of Sydney, wants a similar move to help Hong Kong.
The Australian measure obviously would show international solidarity with Hong Kong people, and it would be helpful to provide some support for the people in Hong Kong, and I think overall it would be good.
Beijing has criticised Australia for interfering in its internal affairs. China's new security law for Hong Kong makes it easier to punish protesters and reduces the city's autonomy. There is a penalty of life imprisonment for the crimes of secession, terrorism and collusion with foreign forces. A Chinese embassy spokesperson in Canberra said the laws would benefit Hong Kong. Creating a special resettlement scheme for asylum seekers from Hong Kong would further inflame tensions between Australia and China, its biggest trading partner. Australia's vocal demand for an international inquiry into the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic, which first emerged in the city of Wuhan, has antagonised China. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You're listening to International Edition. We'll be right back. VOA's International Edition continues. Companies such as Coca-Cola, Adidas, Ford, and Lego are boycotting Facebook this month, pulling ads that appear on the social network in the United States. Some advertisers are part of an organized boycott, demanding the company do more to crack down on hate speech, conspiracies, and misinformation on its site on topics such as voting. Facebook has responded with some changes, but Will it be enough? Michelle Quinn reports.
Hundreds of companies say they won't advertise on Facebook and its sister firm, Instagram, in July as part of a campaign called Stop Hate for Profit. The goal? Force Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg to address Facebook's negative effects on society, says Jim Steyer, chief executive and founder of Common Sense Media and one of the boycott's backers.
That they are amplifying hate speech, racist messages, white supremacy messages, all sorts of misinformation and dishonest political advertising. So we asked the major advertisers of America to pause their advertising on the platform for at least a month.
The boycott's demands include asking Zuckerberg to strengthen controls against hate speech and do more to crack down on misinformation campaigns, particularly when it comes to voting. These are all changes that Facebook can make, says Yael Eisenstadt, who used to head Facebook's elections integrity team for political advertising.
It is within their interest to make small changes. They don't want to be blamed for somebody using their platform to manipulate people in an election. But tinkering around the margins of little changes to ensure that doesn't happen is very different from actually taking a step back and saying, is it possible that the core business we built is actually not the best thing for society?
There's no shortage of ideas of how to fix Facebook. Some call for regulations. Others say break up the company and make Zuckerberg, who has controlling shares of the firm, answerable to a board. One idea, hire ethicists to help with decision-making and give them power in the organization, says Don Heider, executive director of the Markelis Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University.
I don't think there's any one core set of values. I wish there was. And I wish it was some sense of trying to help the common good or trying to protect human rights or something that really helped them be a guiding principle.
Facebook says it doesn't tolerate hate speech and points to its automated system to remove inflammatory ads before users see them. Recently, the firm agreed to an external audit of how it is doing to make sure advertisers do not appear next to harmful messages, one of the boycott organizers' demands. Facebook also said it would label content that breaks its rules, even those posted by an elected official. And it will remove posts that Facebook thinks may lead to violence or deprive people's right to vote. These are important steps, but some critics argue it's not enough. Yael Eisenstadt.
Yes, they can change. It's a question of whether they want to. Can they change as long as they continue to pursue being the biggest, most dominant company in the world that absolutely has a monopoly over all conversations, how we get our content, how we connect with people? Possibly not.
The boycott organizers say their campaign is going global, but it will take time before they know if their efforts have a lasting effect. Michelle Quinn, VOA News, Oakland, California.
Country music pioneer and fiddler Charlie Daniels, who had a major hit with Devil Went Down to Georgia, has died. A statement from his publicist said the Country Music Hall of Famer died Monday due to a stroke. Daniels had performed at the White House, at the Super Bowl, throughout Europe, and often for U.S. troops in the Middle East. Charlie Daniels was 83.
Now, you play pretty good fiddle, boy, but give the devil his...
You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vundanyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great day.
And if you win, you get the shiny fiddle made of gold. But if you lose, the devil gets your soul. The devil opened up his case, and he said, I'll start this show. And fire flew from his fingertips as he rosined up his bow. And he pulled the bow across the strings, and it made an evil hiss. And then a band of demons joined in, and it sounded something like this.